Welcome to Pharma Talk Radio. I'm Kate Woda. Today's program is on innovations in immuno-oncology imaging. I'm delighted to welcome guests Dr. Gregory Goldmacher, Executive Director of Translational Biomarkers and Head of Clinical Imaging for Merck Research Labs, along with Dr. Matthew Silva, Executive Vice President of Scientific Applications for Invigro. Together, Dr. Goldmacher and Dr. Silva will delve into the evolution of treatment response criteria in immuno-oncology, novel tracers monitoring tumor or immune cell populations with imaging, and radiomics, AI, and digital biomarkers. Welcome to you both.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks. Great to be here. Thank you very much.
Okay, let's start by learning a little bit more about each of you and how you're working within the immuno-oncology space, and then we'll turn it over to Dr. Goldmacher to kick us off on the first area of discussion, which will be involving treatment response criteria. Dr. Goldmacher?
Thanks, Kate. So, yes, hello. My name is Greg Goldmacher. I'm trained in diagnostic radiology by background and then went into industry. I spent some time at one of the big imaging core labs, and for the last 3.5 years, I've been in imaging at Merck, of course, leading imaging in a wide variety of immuno-oncology indications, of course, obviously, pembrolizumab, being the flagship product here, a large program and with a lot of innovative features. So immuno-oncology imaging has been evolving fast, as we'll discuss.
Great. Thanks, Greg. It's a real pleasure to be here with you today and with Kate. Thank you very much for the invitation. Happily representing the team here at Invigro, which is one of the world's leading imaging service and software providers. We work with and for pharmaceutical companies in application of imaging biomarkers in clinical trials. My role here and the team here is responsible for scientific and medical services to both the company providing imaging expertise and applications and utilization, but also to our pharmaceutical sponsors. One of our other roles, importantly here, is to drive new strategy and initiatives to ensure that our company and the field continues to support the expanding use of imaging biomarkers, novel radioligands, and advanced analytics in the context of oncology as well as in other therapeutic areas. So again, thank you very much.
All right. So I guess so since our first topic is the evolution of response criteria over time, I guess I'll very briefly summarize the history. And what's really interesting is how rapid the change in response criteria in this space has been. And of course, what I'm going to say here is an amplification extension of discussions that have been presented at IO 360 over the past couple of years. But sort of looking way back, it's interesting. The first set of response criteria, of course, in cancer were the WHO criteria. They came around in about 1980, and they basically were the dominant response criteria in clinical trials for 20 years until RECIST 1.0 came around in about 2000, right? So, of course, response criteria are these rules for evaluating tumor burden over time and defining when there's been progression and when there's been a favorable treatment response. And so these criteria have been used sort of for a variety, both chemotherapy and then for targeted therapy. And then when immuno-oncology treatments started appearing, people noticed this funny thing that there are these atypical patterns of response that you sometimes see, where it looks like the tumor burden increases, but basically that's just a sign the treatment's working. Presumably this is due to infiltration by lymphocytes and proliferation within the tumor, and it looks like the tumor is growing, and then you have a nice response. It doesn't happen in a large proportion of the patients, but it's a common enough phenomenon that people really noticed and realized that the traditional criteria just weren't capturing the full treatment effect here. And so the first of the criteria that was introduced to account for this was Jed Wolchok and his colleagues published a paper in 2009 where they presented what was called the immune-related response criteria. And the thing about those is that they weren't based on RECIST. they were based on WHO, the older WHO criteria. So it was two-dimensional instead of one-dimensional measurements, and the logic was more WHO-like. New lesions were measured and added into the quantitative tumor burden, and progression could only be based on a quantitative change in the tumor burden and not the sort of RESIST paradigm where you combine some quantitative information and some qualitative information and the appearance of new lesions in sort of a logical way. And then, of course, introduced the idea that when you see progression, that may not really be progression. You know, you have to confirm it. So, of course, you know, very quickly after that, RESIST had already kind of taken over as the dominant criteria in clinical trials. So people tried to combine IRRC with RESIST to create some kind of fusion. And so, you know, people called this something like IR RESIST. So the problem was that people took two completely different approaches to this. So, right, so one approach was to take the Wolchok IRRC and just make it one-dimensional. So one-dimensional measurements and change the percent thresholds for change for a progression in response to make it RESIST-like. And then the other approach was to keep the logic of RESIST, but just add a confirmation step after sort of an initial progression. So of course, you know, the problem is if you have two sets of people both calling what they're doing IR RESIST or immune RESIST and completely talking past each other because the rules and the logic are so different. There was a lot of confusion, and people really couldn't compare results across trials and so forth. So around 2016, around the time of ASCO in 2016, a pretty broad group of stakeholders got together, including academia and various pharma companies and the FDA and the NCI and EORTC and the Canadian Clinical Trials Group, a broad variety of stakeholders, and came up with this hybrid system, which has come to be called iRESIST, which was published in 2017 in Lancet Oncology, and has really become now kind of a broadly used approach across industry. And then, of course, things are still changing because there's a whole new and we keep looking for new and better criteria. So, you know, there are now a whole class of therapies that are delivered intratumorally, right? So STING agonists, oncolytic viruses, TLR9s, you know, so various things that are delivered into the tumor and then also have a systemic effect. And, of course, none of the old criteria are adapted to that. So there is now active work developing another set of criteria that will account for intratumoral immunotherapy to be used in combination with systemic immunotherapy. So, you know, as opposed to 20 years of using the same criteria from WHO to RESIST, we've had this rapid evolution and hopefully, you know, not confusing people too much, but, you know, of course, everybody in the field has really had to keep up. Now, the trouble here is, of course, this is all just still using anatomic imaging, CT, sometimes MRI, but basically looking at tumor size. And Matt, you know, I wanted to get your take on this. That, you know, it's interesting that, of course, all of this still doesn't take into account. You would really love to be able to look more directly at the underlying mechanism, right? At what's happening with the cell populations in the tumor. You know, when you have this apparent progression, pseudoprogression, because we think that's lymphocyte infiltration and proliferation, shouldn't there be just a way to just image lymphocyte infiltration in real time?
Yeah, Greg, it's a tremendous question, and that was a really great overview of the evolution of the READ criteria. They're really so critical in assessing response and certainly a way that you can get consistent assessment across drug trials to know that there's sort of an apples-to-apples comparison. And it's certainly true that these pseudo-progressions and these other features that are observed with the anatomical methods, CT and MR, is most likely the result of really complex underlying biology that at this point those imaging methodologies can't specifically elucidate. And in that regard, I think what we've seen historically is that specific elucidation of the underlying biology is done by methods like immunohistochemistry, where you're able to look at cell populations more specifically, look at activation states. In the context of immunotherapy, look at proximity of immune cells to tumor cells. The rise of sequencing is allowing us to do better phenotyping of cell populations. The downside, of course, that these methods have is that it is for the patient problematic in the fact that it requires biopsy. And if you want to look at effect over time, now you're talking about serial biopsy. The other limitation, although they're fantastic measures that give you true cellular visibility into the disease, is that you're only seeing that section of the tumor that was biopsied. So you do not necessarily capture any global heterogeneity, or in a situation where you're dealing with a multiple metastatic disease, you're really only sampling a single lesion. So, you know, what we've seen evolving in the imaging space is, you know, originally the go-to tool in nuclear medicine would be FDG PET, which monitors glucose metabolism in tumors. And with conventional chemotherapy, generally as cells die, their use of glucose as an energy source goes down. And so signal goes down with response. In immunotherapy, it's a little bit more complicated because activated immune cells use glucose as an energy source. So you have this concomitant increase in immune cell uptake and decrease in the tumor cells that can complicate that interpretation. So what I anticipate is, you know, the broad use of FDG PET will really demand continued exploration there. I think folks are going to better understand how to utilize FDG, but at the same time, we're seeing emergence of tools that are more cell type specific. And there are a couple of ways briefly that this can be done. One is, or one a category of methodology is a little bit more indirect. That is looking at biochemical processes within the cells that are specific to activation. So for example, nucleoside salvage is upregulated in activated T cells. And there are probes against deoxycytidine kinase and deoxyguanosine kinase that have been developed to look at this biology. Again, it's not necessarily specific to the cell, but that biochemistry is upregulated in that cell type. We've also seen work out of Umar Mahmood and the group at MGH and now Cytosite to develop granzyme B as an imaging agent. This is a serine protease that is released by activated or CD8 positive T cells. So it's thought to be a relatively specific marker of cell activation in the tumor. And then finally, we've also seen work from groups like ImagineAb, who have brought into phase two studies an anti-CD8 biologic, a radio-labeled a probe for looking at activated T cells expressing CD8. The initial clinical results are highly promising, and hopefully what this is going to allow is for a more personalized approach to the evaluation of a cancer in an individual patient, but also at a lesion level, where you may have some tumors that are full of infiltrate and others that are not. So I hope that we can see that there is going to be a continued utilization of tools such as this, and I would be remiss not to mention great work from David Leung and the team at BMS to develop imaging agents specifically against PD-L1 and radio labeling of their compound as well to look at the biodistribution of a therapeutic along with the target of that drug to look at colocalization and responsiveness at a tumor level. But Greg, as you know, these are complex tools. They're extremely important in early clinical trials to understand the effectiveness of a medicine, the distribution, the responsiveness of individual tumors. But they're more difficult to deploy in a large-scale study, in a multi-center study, So that it would be a more challenging for your team, for example, to leverage these technologies. How are you thinking about utilizing them in the context of your trials?
Well, so as you said, this is, you know, these advanced molecular imaging tools do, you know, essentially they lend themselves well to early phase exploration, deployment in major academic medical centers that have the capabilities to do that kind of scanning. But yeah, it's certainly not something that's easy to deploy in clinical trials. And of course, ultimately, we'd want to be able to use this, you know, to be able to characterize tumor changes in clinical care as well, because, you know, oncologists making treatment decisions have to decide in real time, and they may not be at MGH, but they might be at, you know, some at a community hospital that can't do advanced PET. So I guess this sort of segues us into the last area that we were going to talk about, right, which is radiomics. So yeah, I guess just to tee this up for folks who are not super familiar with this field, the idea is that, you know, tumors, of course, the way we look at them on CT scans and MRI scans normally is just size. How big are they? But there's a bunch of other information hidden in the pixels of the scans. Right? So you can look at not just size, you can look at shape, you can look at density and texture and heterogeneity and border geometry, you know, how smooth versus how stellate or what have you the border of a tumor is, and lots of other things, including sort of higher order properties, mathematical relationships between pixel values. So these numerous features, you know, sort of on the order of hundreds or even many, even much more, and many of them are not available to the human eye at all when you look at a scan to a radiologist. But the idea is there may be properties of the tumor microenvironment, such as, you know, the dominant cell populations, that have signatures of these features, right? So if you measured, you know, a pinch of texture and a dash of border geometry, border morphology, and a little bit of heterogeneity, and you put them together using some kind of formula, those may essentially function as a digital radiological biomarker. And of course, we're only able to even start asking these questions now because of advances in machine learning and artificial intelligence. But so the hope is that you could potentially, you know, look at a tumor's change on a regular clinical CT scan, such as you can do at any hospital. And by, you know, if you find a signature that says, you know, the tumor inflammation in this, the inflammatory level in this tumor is increasing, you know, the T cell population is increasing or what have you, you could distinguish, for example, true progression from pseudo progression without having to wait to confirm to see, you know, the way these criteria work now. Basically, it says wait and see if the, you know, tumor that's growing keeps growing. And so this is all, you know, there's a lot of exciting possibilities. People have been talking about this for a long time. But one of the big obstacles has been that it's always been kind of a black box, right? So, and people don't trust anything that's a black box. So, you know, you could say, oh, well, we'll find a signature that tells you whether a tumor is going to respond or not, or whether it's true progression or pseudoprogression. But how does that really work? One of the big sort of advances in the field came, so last year there was a paper published by a group of folks from France, Roger Sun is the first author on this, that really showed that you can identify a signature on regular clinical CT scans of CD8 positive T cells. So they took a bunch of tumors, and it wasn't even a huge data set. It was like sort of on the order of 100 patients or so, where they had the CD8 beta quantification from each tumor, and they looked at radiomic features within the tumor and trained an AI, a linear elastic net model, to basically recognize the presence of CD8 beta RNA. That was the truth standard, and they trained to it. And then they were able to show in an independent data set, so functionally they were distinguishing hot tumors, you know, inflamed tumors, from immune deserts or non-inflamed tumors. And Then when they looked at another data set from another phase one, it was a basket trial with checkpoint inhibitors for treatment, they were able to classify tumors at baseline, pre-treatment, into inflamed and non-inflamed using their CT signature and predict response to treatment, meaning tumor shrinkage, and also predict survival with a hazard ratio that was pretty stunning. It was a 0.58, I believe, which is a really strong effect, especially given the small number of patients that they were using. Like I said, kind of 100, 150 patients, both for the training and the validation. So, you know, this holds a tremendous amount of promise, I think, because, you know, that's the kind of thing you can deploy. And it has the same kind of promise, Matt, as what you were talking about in the sense of being able to assess non-invasively, longitudinally, from an entire tumor or even from multiple tumors, all the tumors within one patient. And it's something that you could use, you know, once you develop this and deploy something like this, and, you know, there's obviously a lot of work going on this, you could do this not just in clinical care, but not just in clinical trials, but actually in real clinical care. So, you know, oncologist puts a patient on a checkpoint inhibitor, tumor starts growing, but they say, aha, look, the tumor is growing, but the T cell signature is also increasing. That's probably pseudoprogression, and be able to actually drive patient care decisions in real time that way. So I guess my question to you is, you know, because you guys work with a bunch of pharma companies and with, you know, multiple stakeholders across the industry, do you see a lot of interest in this in early phase and late phase? You know, what's your experience been with kind of, you know, taking the temperature of the industry on this technology?
Yeah, it's a really great question, and you raised a couple of very important points that I'll get back to, but first answer your question most directly. There's a tremendous amount of interest using machine learning, radiomics, radiogenomics. It's got a few different flavors of names. That is the combination of multi-omics data that includes imaging to better characterize a current disease state, potentially be able to triage patients better for treatment, or to better evaluate treatment response, or to bin responses to better understand the complexity and heterogeneity in response that exists, not just at the patient level, but potentially, as you point out, at the individual tumor level. The interest that we're seeing in radiomics and in AI applications certainly is around better characterization of data that's coming out of current clinical trials, but we're also finding a tremendous amount of interest within pharmaceutical companies to look at data that they already have. So in other words, pharma has spent the past couple of decades collecting high-quality imaging data in a variety of studies in many different indications, with many different drugs and doses, with clinical data available, so labs, response, and outcome data, and trying to understand whether or not there is additional information that at the time they were unable to glean from simply looking at the reads and understanding did a tumor shrink or did a tumor not shrink. So we're seeing a lot of interest to kind of have this retrospective view and to use that to help build additional confidence, exactly to your point, Greg, that there is a black box aspect here. So let's use some data and some outcomes that are known to try to better understand how we're going to deploy this. The other really important point that you raised that I think the Sun paper can give us all some confidence in is the fact that it actually didn't require a tremendous amount of data to build those models. One of the major issues that AI suffers from often is the requirement for a large volume of data to be able to build these feature sets, to be able to extract some sort of workable model that is both specific but also generalizable. And the fact that it didn't require more than a couple hundred patient scans worth of data is really important and something that will give us a lot of confidence using this going forward. the applications that I see, exactly as you point out, being able to incorporate histology data or RNA-seq data where the tumor microenvironment is characterized at a cellular level, and trying to understand whether or not there was a conventional imaging signature that corresponds with that is really important. And as I mentioned before, developing novel imaging tools can be difficult to deploy in multi-center studies. Not impossible, but can be difficult. And so one of the other questions that's being asked is, well, if we develop an imaging agent to look at CD8 or to look at CD4 or to look at any of these cell-specific markers, could it be that in the conventional image we can use that specific new ligand to help train identification of features that correlate with other important biochemical factors or other cellular markers? That's going to be really important addition. I agree with you that there's a great future here. And one question I want to throw back to you is, as you point out, it's the read criteria are evolving, and there are large consortia of very smart, invested, intelligent people who are developing this read criteria. When will we see an intersection of sort of the human intelligence that's required, so the non-artificial intelligence that is required to understand the imaging physics, the patients, the medicine, the mechanism of action of drugs, and using that to develop this read criteria, and the union of that with these artificial intelligence methods, which may not have all of that background, that don't have our degree of intelligence, but also aren't, it's impossible for a human mind across studies to find these patterns, but computers are well suited. When will we see these come together?
I'm afraid my crystal ball is not functioning at full capacity, Matt. So let me give you a couple of thoughts on that. So first of all, actually, I wanted to follow up on something you said about using the molecular imaging tools that you had described, the specific cell type imaging, to train the AIs to recognize signatures of those cell types from routine clinical studies. I think that's probably going to be critical. And so you mentioned that, you know, you can develop these signatures from, you know, not huge numbers of scans that have already been collected. And it's true. You know, we've got a ton of data. They've already been read. You know, tumors have already been identified, which narrows your search space, et cetera. The problem is getting a good truth standard to train to. Because in a lot of these trials, I mean, I'm, you know, running some research on this now myself, and the challenge is a lot of these trials, the biopsy data to get you a truth standard is, you know, often it's not fresh tissue, it's archival tissue. You often don't know which tumor it came from, so in a large trial, you know this patient got tumor biopsy at baseline, but you don't know which of the, you know, six tumors in a metastatic setting the tissue came from. And so you're training to a gold standard that makes a large assumptions about homogeneity across tumors and over time. And actually, you know, we know that that's not true. We know if cell populations in a tumor change over time. So the idea that you can use that as a good gold standard, I mean, I sometimes say this might be sort of a fool's gold standard. So that actually really interferes with it. So in moving forward with the existing, you know, as we develop better validated molecular imaging tools and can look at it can look at the tumor microenvironment using those tools in those academic centers that can do it, but also, you know, correlating that with contemporaneously acquired CT scans or MRI scans, you know, that you get then, that will give us, I think, better training sets to develop these tools. Now, the question in terms of, you know, putting it all together, what AI does, AI basically is feature recognition pattern recognition that scales, right? So our brains are good at pattern recognition, but there are some things that are just, like I said, not some features and scans that are just not even available to our eyes. And AI is good at recognizing that. How this will dovetail with the evolution of criteria, you know, there is an inherent sort of concern, even though we're an innovation industry, there is an inherent conservatism to the evolution of criteria, certainly in late phase trials, because there's only, you know, the FDA won't accept just any old set of measurements as a surrogate endpoint for drug approval. So, you know, progression-free survival per RECIST 1.1, objective response with duration per RECIST 1.1, those have been around for a while. Everybody's comfortable with it. All of those immune criteria are still just exploratory. And so I think what's going to have to happen is, and I don't see the FDA changing their approach to this in any time soon. That is, they're going to say that before you can start using these nifty new tools, you basically have to have a significant evidence base. So you have to develop them, retrospectively on retrospective data, but then you've got to test those prospectively. So I think that, you know, the next kind of big step, once we get enough of the historical data and do enough of the training and program enough, you know, neural networks to recognize the things we want them to recognize, the next thing is going to have to be building those into clinical trials prospectively to collect data to convince both regulators and, very importantly, caregivers, that this is not voodoo, that this is something that really works to distinguish who needs to get which drugs, when do you stop treating with the drug, and how the patient's doing after treatment. So I think that this is going to be a significant effort over time to collect the data to prove this, you know, rigorously and prospectively.
Yeah, that's fantastic. The other thing I'd point out, knowing that we're coming to our close and could continue talking for hours, I think, but that in addition to the Sun article, there is a great collection of articles that have been curated by Nature, specifically on radiomics, that are currently open access. And so I definitely would encourage listeners who aren't as familiar with this space, or even if you are, there's a broad range of use cases available there. I would encourage folks to have a look. And with that, perhaps, Kate, you know, we should say thanks and throw it back over to you.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you both so much for this discussion. We will continue the discussion on imaging aspects for cancer immunotherapy at the Immuno-Oncology 360 Summit in New York City, February 26th through 28th, 2020. For more information, visit www.io360summit.com or theconferenceforum.org. To learn more about Invicro's quantitative imaging biomarker services and how they can help you support your research through the drug development process, please contact their team at info@invicro.com. Thanks for listening.